I'd like to welcome Katie Schultz to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you.
Since 2011, Katie has directed the Adult Writers Retreat at the Interlochen College of Creative Arts. And Katie, kudos to you. Over the years, I've heard about your inspirational teaching and your wise counsel from so many of your students. When we last chatted in 2013, you had a new book called Flashes of War. Over the years, this book has gained a lot of traction as an important part of the literature of the Iraq War, and most of the pieces in Flashes of War referred to as flash fiction. Would you remind our listeners what flash fiction is?
Sure. It's one of my favorite things to write and teach, so thank you for asking. It is a story of the moment, or you might say a work of art carved on a grain of sand. Typically, it can be flash fiction or nonfiction. Either genre is fine, and it's 1 to 3 pages long, so maybe 250 to 750 words. And typically, it just covers like a single moment in time, although, of course, there are always exceptions. We're dealing with really potent, often lyrical prose that just doesn't have to worry about backstory and primarily focuses on yearning, stakes, and precision.
And today we're talking about your novel, which is the opposite of flash fiction. Instead of talking about 2 or 3 pages, we're talking about 250 pages. How did this happen?
I'm still trying to figure it out. It was very dizzying, but I really did have to teach myself how to write long. And there's actually a connection to the impetus for the novel to this place here in Michigan. I could tell that story if you'd like.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure. So I was here directing the writer's retreat in 2012, and one of our faculty at the time for the week-long experience at the College of Creative Arts was Jamie Gordon, author of Lord of Misrule and other wonderful books.
National Book Award winner.
Right, that Jamie Gordon.
Yes.
And we were on a short break between sessions, and I just popped in to check my email really quick, and I had a message from an agent in New York who I greatly respected, and it said, oh, you know, dear Katie, I found one of your short stories in this small literary magazine published out of Idaho, and I really enjoyed it. Have you ever thought about writing a novel? And I started screaming when I read the email, kind of out of shock and uncertainty. And Jamie came running into the room. She said, who died? What happened? Are you okay? And I just like handed her my computer. And she said, well, why are you screaming? And I said, well, I mean, this is lovely, but I have to write him back and tell him, oh, thank you. But I know I'm not a novelist. I don't write novels. And she basically stood over my shoulder and helped dictate a message that I sent back to the agent that said, oh, yes, I'm so glad you asked. I am working on a novel. And are you interested? And I clicked send, and he wrote back several hours later and said, great, can you send me the first 50 pages? And I showed Jamie the message, and she coached me through the rest of it. But long story short, the agent said, okay, well, send me those first 50 pages in 5 weeks. And so there was my first assignment, and I had to learn to move from being a flash writer into the novel.
So getting into the novel, how did you learn novel form? How did you study this?
That's exactly the right word, studying. And the best writers that I know and respect are always studying. So I had many models to follow in that regard. What I knew I needed to learn about most was structure, the structural components of prose. So I had gotten really comfortable with scene, with metaphor, and with maybe single sentence long jabs of backstory. You can do all of that in flash, and you should be able to do it well. But the novel is the long exhale. Charles Baxter says flash can win you by total knockout. But the novel wins you by points, if you will, go with the boxing metaphor. And so I had to figure out, how do you win the reader by points in the long exhale? I had happened to be reading a novel by Ursula Hedgie called Children in Fire. That novel takes place over the course of one day. And Ursula Hedgey is one of my favorite writers. I really admire her literary fiction. And I knew that the kernel of this novel that had been, you know, sitting in with me for all of 24 hours by that point was, I at least knew that it would probably take place over one day. So now I'm taking a novel length amount of time to answer your question. So I'll speed it up and I'll say that I basically locked myself in an office when I wasn't teaching. And on the left side of my desk, I had Ursula Hedgey's Children in Fire. And on the right side of my desk, I had a blank piece of paper and a pen. And I analyzed and copied and outlined her structure literally sentence by sentence. Here is one sentence of dialogue followed by two sentences of backstory and three sentences of description. Line break. Full flashback, including full scene and two paragraphs of backstory. Line break. New speaker. To that level. And then I modeled the structure, but filled it in with my own content. It was terrifying. I thought I was breaking all these writing laws and the lawyers and prose police were going to come, you know, banging down the doors and put me in cuffs at any minute. But I, for the time being, I knew no one would ever have to know what I was doing or see what I was writing. Years later and many drafts later, the novel takes place over 3 days. It's told on the limited third point of view from three characters, and it resembles nothing of that original structure, but I never could have gotten there without the early imitation and education.
Imitation. It works, doesn't it?
It does.
So this book is set around, what, 2012?
2009, the summer of 2009, yep. And it's set in Afghanistan and Oristan province, and then also in parts of western North Carolina, modeled after where I've lived for the last 15 years.
I was interested to see that come through. And most writing teachers, I think we're all guilty of saying this, write what you know, but it's also important to write what you don't know.
Yeah.
And these were worlds that you didn't know, life in an Afghan village, life in the U.S. military with a deployed unit, two very different cultures. How did you research this to get it right?
Thank you for seeing that. I really like to teach write what you don't know. I think in some ways it challenges you to cover your bases more precisely and thoroughly than you would when you start working with material based on experience. So in my case, I had done so much research for Flashes of War that it freed me up to focus on the structural components of prose when I was writing the novel. So that research was all already in me, and my learning could focus on the aspects of prose that were most challenging to me as a relatively new writer. However, when I was doing that research, it was everything from YouTube videos and satellite images from Google search engines or Google Maps to reading books like Doug Stanton's Horse Soldiers, for example, or watching documentaries to understand more about the burqa.
Which is the type of dress.
Yeah, whether it was on or off in certain provinces at certain times in history, a little bit about Pashtun culture. But there was so much complexity. When you get into Pashtun culture or tribal loyalties or even just the great spanning history of this beautiful country of Afghanistan, that I had to be careful to create a character that would feel authentic and whole, but that wouldn't bite off more than I could chew, so to speak. And so I found Asaya and her husband Rahim and made them work and double triple checked my facts, and I hope it's proving true.
And this was actually based on some historical information that you had gathered.
Yeah, so a story always starts for me with an unanswered question. And I had read this article years after the fact. It actually broke in 2009, but I don't think I read it until 4 or 5 years later. The first article was in The Nation, and then there many others followed, and it was about the host nation trucking practices. And in particular, this article revealed how American cash moved from hand to hand. So in order for the men and women living on forward operating bases in Afghanistan to get what they needed for their basic day-to-day operations of living and of conducting war, they have to have supplies. And those supplies have to be delivered. And they're not being delivered by, 18-wheelers rolling down I-81. They are being delivered by Afghan trucking companies. And the U.S. hired those companies to do the job. The only way that those trucking companies could guarantee safe passage of the trucks and the goods from point A to point B was to take that cash and to do what is legit and customary and common practice and part of a unique economy in Afghanistan, which was to bribe local warlords, hey, let these trucks pass through. And in turn, those warlords, in order to guarantee that passage, often would have to hand cash further down the line to Taliban that had various loyalties and holdings in parts of their provinces. And so you could see, as a whole other way of looking at trickle-down economics, how a dollar would pass from hand to hand to hand. The unanswered question I had was, what consequences, what singular moment could have happened because of the way these dollars moved? And I had the moment in my mind's eye. I knew the scene. I knew that it would be in the final 20% of the book, and I had to write my way toward it.
I'm talking with Katie Schultz, and we're talking about her new novel, Still Come Home. Katie, can I get you to read from the book for us?
Sure. I'll read an excerpt from a chapter focused on Second Lieutenant Nathan Miller. So this is limited third point of view, and you'll hear me mention Sissy, his daughter, and Tenley, his wife. So Nathan Miller has gone back home for a brief visit at Thanksgiving time, and they are at a local park in western North Carolina. Sissy squealed with laughter and raised her pudgy arms as she whooshed down the slide. Miller marveled at the simplicity of it, how readily joy came bursting forth. He put his arms around Tenley and smelled her citrus shampoo and cinnamon bark perfume. Nothing about her seemed to give. He moved closer, but she felt iron-plated, as if any assurance this short time before redeployment might afford didn't matter anyway. There was so much he wanted to say, even more he'd promised he wouldn't hold back, but she would never understand what it was like to have someone die on your watch. "I love you," was all he could muster. For a moment, it almost seemed to be enough, but when Tenley pulled away, Miller forced himself to look her in the eyes. It was then he saw that her tightness stemmed from decisions she had come to in his absence. He recognized something fierce and bolstered there. She'd been fighting too, slow and steady, on the home front. He had waited to tell her about going back to FOB Copperhead in person, because the bonus and promotion would set them ahead for the future, for their family, but he didn't tell her it was also a chance to prove himself capable again, the ghost of Mercer biting at his every thought. Studying her in the park, he knew waiting had been a mistake. "Baby, let's go sit down," he said. "We can watch Sissy from our spot." He tried to guide Tenley to the park bench, but she insisted on walking a half step ahead of him. He looked at her petite shape, the way the smooth curve below her ribs widened at her pelvis, the way her legs held her upright so infallibly. The war had done that to him, making him keenly aware of how entwined flesh and bone really are. Likewise, how readily they betray one another. But the war also gave the mundane back, offering the simplest pleasures in technicolor. Drip coffee on an automatic timer, the feel of bare feet across a carpeted living room. The park view expanded outward from where they sat, the horizon circling back as if it started and ended at Tenley. It may have been cliché, but Miller felt it. His world rose and set by that woman, her dimpled cheeks, her tiny earlobes, her southern drawl that came so softly and sweetly it made him woozy. She was the first woman he ever felt understood that his quiet way came carefully calculated. Others misjudged it for defiance or passivity, but she always held a vision of his highest potential at the forefront. He could feel it just as surely as he felt the mountains around them, holding everything together in this rural Appalachian bowl where Miller had moved his life to prove his love and come around to opportunities just like this.
Katie Schultz, reading from Still Come Home. Katie, the copy that I've been working from is called an advanced reader's copy, which means the book is not out yet. When will this book be on the market?
October 1st is the official release, although pre-orders will unlock sometime summer of 2019.
And where will the book be available from?
Anywhere books are sold, so you can buy it from Loyola University Maryland's Apprentice House Press website, from my website, katieschultz.com, from Amazon, from indie booksellers.
Okay, and I have to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Now we've gone from flash fiction to the novel. What's next?
Oh, thank you for asking that. I have been working on a collection of short stories set in Appalachia for the last few years. I am about 8 stories in, and that's where I'm headed. We'll see if I can round out the collection with maybe 4 more stories, and then I'll start thinking about how I want to have it meet the world.
Good. Thank you so much for being here. Katie Schultz, the novel is Still Come Home.